Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the GeoMob Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about bat distribution modeling with our guest, Tom Foxley from Bath University. Hi there, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Yep, all good. Thank you. Looking forward to this. So maybe we can start with you introducing yourself to the listeners a little bit about your background and sort of how you got into bats.
Right, sure. So I'm an ecologist, conservation biologist. I work at the University of Bath. I'm currently doing a postdoc at the University of Bath. Well, I've worked with bats since 2011. Was my first bat job, was a radio tracking job for Bristol Uni, and then after that, I worked as a consultant ecologist for about 10 years, specializing. I say I was a consultant. I didn't really do any consulting. I was just doing the field work, the fun bits. I was a freelancer. So I did a lot of radio tracking and tree climbing, looking for bats in trees, stuff like that. And then in 2020, I started my PhD, which is using spatial approaches for bat conservation, to develop a better approach for protecting bats in the planning system. Was kind of the focus of my PhD.
Okay, cool.
So then now I'm sticking more with the research side of things now.
And so I'm guessing it was mainly the results of your PhD that I've seen that made me think that you'd be really good to come on the podcast and talk about some of the spatial stuff. But maybe you're carrying on that type of work as well in what you're doing now. So maybe there'll be some opportunity to talk about sort of the latest research that you're doing. But before we get into all of that, maybe we can have a little bit of a chat about why bats are interesting and why they're important. So maybe keeping it to the UK, but sort of where are they found? What are some of the standard tools for monitoring bats and sort of like why should we be monitoring them?
Well, so I think you can restrict it to the UK. Bats, that's one of the most amazing things about bats. So obviously, well, they're just cool because they're mammals that can fly. They use their hands to fly, which is just amazing in itself. And that's enabled them to spread around the world and fill all these amazing niches that they do in other parts of the world, where they eat, drink blood, you know, eat frogs. And that's part of what's so amazing about bats. But so if we're restricting it to the UK, bats are they're all over the UK. They're all insectivorous in the UK, and so they're an important part of the ecosystems that we have in the UK. So most of the UK is incredibly degraded in terms of wildlife, but bats have managed to hang on, and they're still fulfilling this really important ecological role.
From
our perspective, that they say they eat a lot of crop pests is something. They're very like an ecosystem service that they provide. It's from a human-centric perspective, that's a reason to protect them, if not just for their intrinsic value.
So are there loads of different species of bat in the UK, or is it a relatively small number of species, and are they evenly distributed across the country?
So there's 18 species, well, 18 species that are present in the UK, 17 that breed in the UK, and no, there's, right. there's greater diversity in the south, particularly in the southwest. You get more species, and the number of species drops the further north you go, generally.
Okay.
I'm not sure how many you have in Scotland, but it's more like nine or ten.
Yeah. Okay. You've already mentioned in your introduction as well that part of your previous life was sort of looking in trees for bats and radio tracking of bats. Can you say a little bit about those sort of, I'm going to show my ignorance here, but those traditional inverted commas methods of sort of looking for bats, like, are those the only two, or are there more? And what does radio tracking involve?
Radio tracking. You trap. You put out a net to trap bats, and you glue a tiny little radio transmitter on its back, and then set it free, and then follow it around for the next. Well, they last tend to last about a week or so. The okay. transmitters. It's an amazing approach. You do get amazing data from it. There's obviously, if you've got a tiny, fast-moving animal moving around at night and you're trying to triangulate to get its position, which is what you end up doing, there's obviously some inaccuracy in that. So it's good, but it's limited when you compare it with like modern the latest technology is to use GPS, which is actually what I was doing in my PhD. I was using GPS rather than radio tracking, which is obviously much more accurate.
Hang on, sorry to interrupt. Am I right in thinking you put GPS trackers onto the back of a bat?
Yeah. Tiny.
Awesome. Okay.
So about 1 gram. I think there are some that are a bit smaller than a gram now, but at the time 1 gram was the smallest. And that obviously wow. limits the size of the bat you can attach it to. So it's got to be, the weight of the tag has got to be less than 5% of the bat. So then you right. can only do it with the larger UK species because the smaller ones wouldn't be able to carry it. It would affect them too much. So wow. there's still a place for radio tracking because they haven't, until they develop tags that are smaller. The other thing about the GPS tag is that you have to retrieve it. The ones that I had, you have to retrieve to be able to get the data from it. So it has to be a species that you know where it's going to go. Like, so there are some species that switch roost every night, so you're not guaranteed to get your tags back. And when they cost about, I don't know, 400-500 quid each. So it's if you're tagging a load of them, you're not getting them back. It can be very expensive. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
But yeah. So radio tracking was when I had these GPS tags on the bats, I actually also had a radio tag glued to it. And the first year I was doing it, I was out tracking the bats just in case, because I didn't know how well the GPS was going to work. And it also helps you if the tag falls off somewhere. The idea was then you could retrieve it using the radio tag. When we, at the end of the season, when I compared the radio tracking data that I got from my tracking and the GPS data, you can really see the difference. Like, the radio tracking data is a lot more, there's a lot of fixes near the roost, and then as you go further out from the roost, which is where the bats were roosting, you know, the data drops off because you just have trouble finding them. So you get this very kind of biased data, and you get good data for a few bats, and then some bats you just have no idea where they went, because we had one bat that was, we were trying to track it for about 5 nights. We were trying to work out where it was going, and it would fly, start off going like to the north, and then it would just vanish. And luckily we got the GPS tag back for that, and found that what it was doing was going, turning around and going for 14 kilometers in the other direction, down to Chew Valley Lake, which is miles from where we started. Yeah. I think with radio tracking, you miss a lot of the data. Those bats that disappear off miles away, you're just much less likely to encounter them. So you get this bias in the data.
So some of them are going quite large distances in a night then. So if you're looking to do spatial modelling of the sort of distribution, I guess, of where they go when they're foraging, you're going to need to cover a large area.
So we were finding these are greater horseshoe bats, so they're one of the largest species, so they're able to travel quite far. They were going kind of up to 14 kilometres away from the roost every night. Yeah, so it's quite a big area. Yeah. This was, I think it's dependent upon the number of bats that are at the roost. So this is it's a maternity colony in North Somerset, and at the time there was between six and eight hundred bats at the roost. So I think if there's that many bats, they've got to obviously, you know, everything close to the roost, all of the food, the foraging resources get depleted. So I think that means they have to travel further to get to find somewhere, you know, to forage. So it's dependent.
Yeah, that's amazing. The next thing I think we should probably discuss is I've seen some of the results of the spatial modelling that you've done for North Somerset and the sort of area around the Mendip Hills. Could you explain a little bit about your models and how you built them and sort of like what the driver was for doing that work?
Yeah, so I'll start with the rationale. I think it makes for the modelling. So all bats are protected in the UK. But when I say they're protected, for most species it means that their roosts are protected. So you're not allowed to, and the individual bats themselves, you're not allowed to disturb them when they're in their roosts or disturb okay. destroy their roosts. But then for some of the rarer species, there's four species that have this extra level of protection, greater horseshoes and lesser horseshoes being two of those. You have these special areas of conservation set up to protect those species. And so what that means is so you'll have the actual SAC itself is quite small, so it'll be the roost that they're using. So in North Somerset, it's a maternity roost, a single maternity roost is the actual SAC. But then the habitat around the roost is in effect protected because you're not allowed to do anything that can negatively impact the bats roosting in the SAC. So then suddenly you've got to protect the habitat that the bats are using, which if you've got 600... greater horseshoe bats roosting in the centre of your county, like in which is what they have in North Somerset, and these bats can go up to 14 kilometres every night. That means basically everywhere in North Somerset, these bats is being used by these bats. And so anytime anyone wants to build anything, it has to go through a habitats regulations assessment, and it's a big headache for the developers and for the council. It's just a lot of admin and... it makes things difficult, and then it's also quite hard to understand or to know how a development might be impacting them if you don't understand how the bats are using the landscape. So my supervisor Emma Stone, she developed the idea for my PhD in collaboration with North Somerset Council and Natural England to try to develop, you know, a better approach to dealing with that. That's the rationale behind it. To give the council or local decision makers this amazing understanding of how bats are using the landscape so that they can make better informed decisions,
right.
Development decisions. The main threat that development poses to bats is through habitat loss and through loss of landscape connectivity, which essentially can result in the same thing. If the bats aren't able to access the habitat through a lack of connectivity, then it's the same kind of impact. So those were the two modelling approaches I took to understand how the bats are using the landscape.
Sorry, I was just going to say, is connectivity really important for bats, given that they're relatively small? Are they using sort of linear features in the landscape in order to get around the landscape? Is that key?
Yeah. Some species more than others, but horseshoe bats particularly, they use very high frequency echolocation, which high frequencies attenuate quite quickly in air. So they don't really, if they're echolocating, they don't really have a very... they're kind of short-sighted, I suppose, is one way of saying it. So that they're known to use linear features as navigation routes. And the other thing is that they're clutter specialists. They're adapted to flying in clutter. So it's a predation security, you know, it stops them being predated if they can dive into a bush quickly. It makes them a bit safer when they're flying around as well. So, yeah, they definitely do depend. But there are other species that fly really high and will just fly over everything. So it's species specific. The amount that like linear features and stuff are used. So the two types of models that I built, so there were habitat suitability models and landscape connectivity models. So your listeners will have probably heard of these, the packages that I used were Maxent for habitat suitability modeling and CircuitScape for landscape connectivity models.
Both of those are in R, yeah.
The Maxent is in R. You can do that Maxent in R, but CircuitScape is in Julia.
Okay.
The latest one's in Julia, which makes it a lot quicker, because that's the one I use. So I had this GPS tracking data. I did two summers of GPS tracking of two different maternity roofs of greater horseshoe bats. And then I used that data as the input for the habitat suitability model. So the habitat suitability model, it needs species locational record, and then then you take a load of environmental layers, like all the GIS layers describing the landscape, and it looks for associations between, you know, the habitat that the species are using and what the environmental conditions are at those location points. And then you use that to predict, you know, where suitable habitat will be over the whole of your study area. So I built two different habitat suitability models. One based on one of foraging habitat and one of commuting habitat. I did that from the GPS fixes. I applied a clustering algorithm to look for clusters of GPS fixes. So I defined a cluster as being if a bat was staying in one spot within kind of a kilometer within for more than half an hour, then I was defining that as foraging activity, because one of these bats could fly 14 kilometers quite easily in half an hour, probably, if it had to. So if it's staying in one spot, then it's clearly doing something there. That was kind of the rationale for that.
Right,
and then all the other points were then commuting habitat. So you're differentiating those two behaviors in the GPS data. And then so the foraging habitat, that was the result. One of the outputs that we wanted was to know where the best foraging habitat for the species was. And then the commuting habitat went in as the base layer for the connectivity model. CircuitScape, have you heard of CircuitScape? It's kind of developed from connectivity modeling. Sorry, what was I saying?
Okay.
Electrical modeling. So it treats a map of the landscape kind of like a circuit board. So you'll have areas of high resistance and areas of low resistance. The areas of high resistance representing areas that are hard for wildlife to pass through, and low resistance being areas that are easy for wildlife to pass through. And then you apply a current across the board from a start point to an end point, and it will show you all the various ways in which, like, the kind of path of least resistance, almost at the current being the flow of animals or wildlife, the path it would take. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So I use the commuting habitat suitability to define ease of movement with that as that, like, kind of base map. And then knowing where the roofs were, you can then have the roost as the start point, and then the bats can move out into the landscape to all the areas of best foraging habitat. So you have you end up building this model of the routes that the bats are likely to take between the roost and their foraging ground. Does that make sense? It's kind of hard.
So is that your start point and your end point? Is the roost is the start point and the foraging ground is the end point?
Yeah, so the bats are moving. Actually, it's in reverse, but essentially it's exactly right. The same. You actually have the roost as the ground point, and then you have the bats starting in the areas of foraging habitat. So higher suitability foraging habitat will get more current injected to it than lower suitability foraging habitat, which makes sense because the bats are going to be going to, you presume the bats will be travelling more towards the better foraging areas. So okay. Created by foraging habitat. And then, yeah, then you run it and it all the current travels back to the roost, which is the reverse, but it's exactly the same.
Yeah, okay. And do you just iterate that for as many start points as you have? Is that the idea?
You do that for each roost. Yeah, that's every roost in the study area. So it depends. That was fine for greater horseshoes where their roosts are reasonably well known. But then there are other species where you wouldn't be able to do that because they move roosts every night, and especially tree roosting species, people don't really know where they are all the time. They have to go.
Right.
Which is why I spent years as an ecologist going around looking for roosting trees. They tend to be a bit more ephemeral. The big ones might be easier to spot, but I don't know, it depends on the species. So the project I'm working on at the moment is using, I want to be able to build these same models for every species of bat. Using an acoustic approach rather than a telemetry approach as the input, data input. So it's going to be, I'm going to have to rethink the approach for a lot of species because it's different. If you don't have good roost data, you can need to take a different approach.
So given the area that we're talking about, we're talking about the whole of North Somerset, which it's not a large county, but it's still a county. So, and you were sort of running your model over that. So you've mentioned already that you're using Julia to speed things up, but did you find that you needed to run it on like a high powered computer, or was this like, is it sufficient to run it on something like a decent laptop or whatever in order to do it? Or it sounds like there's a lot of processing involved.
Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah, so it was bigger than North Somerset. It was North Somerset, Bath and North East Somerset, and then the former county, former districts of former Mendip and Sedgemoor districts, which are now just part of Somerset.
Oh, right.
So it was quite a big area. And yeah, I the first time I ran it, it was on my laptop, and it took 2 weeks to complete, and I had to do that twice. So it took a month. But then I started using AWS, where Amazon Web Services, where you can just say, I want loads of processors and RAM, and then it did it in about 2 hours.
Wow. Okay. That's really interesting just to understand that sort of processing. Because, yeah, I guess if you had really good input data in terms of where bats were roosting and good quality sort of environmental variables as well for, I don't know, let's say for the whole of England, could this be run as a method for the whole of England, or does it need to be done at sort of like local scale?
I'd like to do it one day. If you could get, you'd need very good data. So that's the problem. So the environmental data is there. So you've got this is just to clarify. This is I was doing everything at a 10-meter resolution, which is really high res, but it means you can pick out individual hedgerows and stuff, which are potentially important on a really fine scale for foraging. So if you kept it at that resolution, I don't know how you'd do that. You'd need a lot of processing power to do that on a large scale and a lot of input data. So you couldn't get GPS data, on that kind of scale. It would have to use an acoustic approach, basically. You couldn't, right. It'd be too disruptive to be tracking bats all over the country. And also you can't do it for every species, like I mentioned before, just because the tags are too big for the smaller species. And radio tracking is not accurate enough. If you've got 100 meter kind of margin of error in a radio track and fix, then it's either in on the hedgerow or in the middle of the field and you can't distinguish it. And if it's really important for the modelling, then that's not going to work.
Okay.
But this is what I'm working on at the moment is using acoustic data as the input instead. So in North Somerset, my supervisor, the Bat Lab and North Somerset Council run together. It's the North Somerset Bat Survey. So it's a big citizen science project. So they've got this acoustic data that they've been gathering for the last 5 years, and it's. What I'm working on is being able to feed that into the models to use that, because there's this ton of data that is there's definitely data in there about how bats are using the habitat, but it's the challenge is going to be with the biases in the data. Obviously, like, people tend to put them in their gardens a lot because that's what they want to find out, you know, like, what's flying in my garden. So if you've got a lot of gardens, and obviously, because when you're attaching a bat detector, you have to put it on something. So it's always attached to a hedge or a tree line or a fence or something. Mm-hmm. So you don't have any data. You don't have data from the middle of the field. So I'm going to need to work out a way around that. Might be some additional surveys, putting detectors out in the middle of the field and somehow cow proofing them. So this kind of big data, you can, if you have these huge acoustic data sets, you can get data from the whole year. Like if you could have detectors out all year round, there's a lot of information that you can be getting there, which on a temporal scale, like you could do this all year round. So you could do some really cool things.
I find it fascinating that, like, you've started off in the field as an ecologist, and now you've got the classic data scientist problem, which is loads of data, but it's really messy, and you need to try and work out how to make it tidy and get what you want. It's brilliant. So the paper that explains what you've just been talking about will be in the show notes as well, and I really want people to go and have a look at it, particularly the connectivity outputs, because they're amazing. The way I guess I would describe them is a bit like those Van de Graaff machines that you get, where you sort of put your hand on them and then all the electricity flows to your hand. You can sort of see that, the whole analogy in the way that those outputs are generated. They certainly are very visually stunning. What sort of feedback have you had from people that you've shown about these two different types, so the habitat indexes and the connectivity?
Well, so it's all being used by the council at the moment. They used it in developing in their new local plan, in developing a special planning document for how to deal with the, you know, greater horseshoe bats in North Somerset, and they're developing there's a scheme called North Somerset Nature Parks, where it's an offsetting scheme where you pay into you can buy habitat credits from them, and so the modelling is always used to find places, the best places to put these parks, and it's been used for, what else has it been used for, a few different things to directing local planning decisions. So it's been useful, I think, at least. It is. So that was kind of the best feedback, really. And I'm working with the council to keep them up to date, on this new project now, to keep it going indefinitely into the future. Because, obviously the radio tracking data, it was collected at one point in time, and then you can't keep using that same model forever, so keeping the models up to date is going to be important for it to be useful, for the modelling to be useful in the long term.
Yeah. Are there any of the sort of geospatial and environmental input data sets that need to be updated as well, or can you continue to use it? I'm guessing you're using things like LiDAR and maybe the land cover map from CEH, stuff like that.
Yeah. Exactly those. Yeah. Well, so the land cover map comes out every year, so that's good. Yep. And then NDVI was one other thing. So I need to write a script to automate downloading and processing some Landsat imagery to keep NDVI up to date. That's fine. So the LIDAR data is the national, is from the National LIDAR Project, which I don't know. Is do you know? Is it? Is that still? Is it going to keep getting updated? Because from what I've read, said that they didn't plan to resurvey everything. But I don't know.
That is a good question. Yeah, I also don't know. If any of our listeners know, that would be very useful for them to get in touch and let us know. But yeah, I've sort of seen the same thing as you, that it got collected and it's there's not funding in place for continual updates.
Yeah, I think because one of the main objectives was to make a DTM, but then so the terrain's not going to change necessarily so much. But for me, what's interesting is that, you know, the vegetation layer, which is going to change. And so even like when I was using it at first, like some of the squares were, there's quite a range. Some of them were from 2017, so some of them when I was using it were already 5 years old. So, you know, if you've got a hedgerow,
yeah,
and you've got the height data of that from five years ago, that's going to become irrelevant quite quickly, isn't it? So yes. There's other approaches you can use. There's, you know, the Sentinel-2 microwave kind of data that you can use to calculate height of stuff, I think.
Yeah.
There might be a different approach.
There's all sorts of various bits and bobs you can put in, I guess. Do you make the decision about what data goes through into the model, or is there some way of there being like a process at the beginning of the model to work out which ones cross-correlate and which ones would be most useful, have the most information in there that would be useful for the model?
No, it was just me kind of tweaking it. Yeah, you've got to kind of think. You've got to choose something that there's a good biological reason for you to include it in the model. It's not just trying stuff at random. And I wasn't doing any kind of like automated process for choosing the best ones, which is like model selection or anything. No, you've got to just based on the species, and you know you've got to think what's actually relevant and there's all sorts of different ways to describe the same things, isn't there? So like the land cover and the LIDAR, and it all kind of overlaps a bit, doesn't it, if you think of vegetation cover.
Yeah.
So it's getting the combination right.
And yeah, it's always tricky with this thing.
Kind of the same thing, because there's a lot of those. So yeah. So I'd like to simplify it in future, and I'd probably have to remove the LIDAR from the model just because it's gonna become out of date, isn't it, if it's not
that's true,
if it's not kept up to date.
It might be worth that is a tricky one, trying to find out how you can get very high resolution sort of elevation information that's continually updated, because you're right, a lot of particularly with all the development that's planned as well, not only are you going to get things being removed and added into the environment, but also things will be cut back in order to allow some of that development, I guess. So you're going to get those height changes. So yeah, there you go, that's an interesting problem for you for the next couple of years. Keep you on your toes. It's been brilliant talking to you. Our time is coming to an end, unfortunately. Is there anything that you want to add around either the modelling or a particular message that to send our listeners about bats and sort of bat conservation and that sort of thing?
Nothing I can think of, no.
Okay. Put you on the spot there.
Yeah.
But if listeners did want to know more, how can they get in touch with you and your team?
My email is probably the best. I'm not on any social stuff anymore.
Okay.
There's the lab website. It's got all my contact details. Bat Conservation Research Lab.
And that'll be in the show notes, yeah.
Yeah, fine. Yeah, email. Yeah, no, I'm not on Twitter or anything. I did have a Twitter, but no, not anymore.
No. Yes. Okay. That's been absolutely brilliant, Tom. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking to us about this. I really genuinely look forward to see where the models go. They are fascinating.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob Podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.